It is the most tried and by far the most constant friend which poor humanity can possess. Its breast is a pillow upon which every head may safely lie in weariness, its arms are never full, and every outcast vagabond is always sure of its caress. In its disrespect of persons it comes nearer the character of God than any other attribute of earth. The saint and sinner, the prodigal and thrifty, the profligate and prudent receive from sleep an equal salutation. She has no power to judge, and faithful to the work assigned her, welcomes to her house alike the assassin and his judge, the rival armies of contending nations, the hunted and the hunter, and bids them rest beneath her sure protection without a sense of fear. Some call her fickle and uncertain, and seek to find in her that measure of perfection impossible to be attained by earth, of whom she is a child. Upon themselves let all the blame of her shortcomings fall, since the error is their own for lifting up a standard nothing mortal has power to reach. Who dares to rise and say she has her favorites in the family of man? If any speak and seek to bring such evidence, it will be found that in her seeming choice the great nobility of her soul will shine more beautifully bright. Where would such be found? Not in the palace or the mansion where flattering courtiers or whining sycophants are wont to seek for place or power, but in the hovel or the den she may be found to linger perhaps in tender sympathy, while she seeks to close the eyelids with a surer seal. Here with her godlike grasp she curbs the cravings of the hungry stomach, and with her visions makes endurance possible till tardy relief brings up supplies, or else, in concert with her sister Charity, she lingers by the bed of pain, that her anesthetic charm may numb the poignant shafts which make the victim long for ease or death. Within the audience chamber of her home what severed hearts have been united, what prodigals persuaded to return, and what misunderstandings explained. Yea, has she not done even more than this? For when the sorrowing mother, father, friend has fallen fainting into her arms, broken, hearted at the loss of one whom death has slain, has sleep not, once and again, come forth to champion the cause of the bereaved, and standing at the gate of death exerted the power that made the cruel bolts give way, and held the gate ajar while dead and living met again in communion hallowed by the parting? This, and far more than this, had she been to me, of all my earthly friends most dear, and at the moment of my waking I was conscious she was withdrawing her hand from mine and I should never grasp it more. Through all the vicissitudes of life she had been my faithful companion, the only one, so far as memory served me, who had never in any single instance forsaken me. No, we were parting, she had reached the limit of her domain, but my path lay onward across a future without a horizon, a sunset or a daybreak. In such a life there was no need for sleep. Is it strange or wonderful that I should woo the fading sensation to linger in its adieu? Yet I was not sorry to part from such tried and pleasant companionship, it marked a stage in ascent of the ladder of life. I was grateful for the service it had rendered me, but the newly acquired powers were taking hold upon me, and I was anxious to secure the possibilities they brought within my reach. Therefore we parted with the earnest wish that every needy soul would find her as faithful and consoling as she had been to me, and when in turn they too should part from her pleasant company that it would be with the fragrant memories I should continue to cherish. I had scarcely recovered myself before my attention was attracted to a man who might be the doctor of the imaginary sanatorium in whose grounds I had been reposing. He was at some distance from me when I first saw him, and as he neared, made frequent stoppages with one and another of the convalescents as if inquiring after their welfare and condition. This gave me an opportunity of observing him before he reached me, for I felt confident that such was his destination. Contrary to Erasmus, he was rather short in stature, but being spare of build it was not so noticeable as might otherwise have been the case. His face and complexion was Egyptian, with bright liquid black eyes brimming over with kindness and good humor, the first physiognomic reading of it proclaiming him to be an embodiment of sympathy and tenderness. In age he might be young, but there was something in his action and movement which made me think he was old, very old, and that his lithe and youthful vigor were necessary to bear the weight of that experience so obviously manifest in everything he did. There was none of the nervousness and excitement about him one naturally looks for in young men who are clothed in the mantle of authority, no impatience at being hindered or reluctance to perform an unexpected duty. On the contrary, each and every transaction he was called upon to execute, no matter how trivial, was attended to with a thoroughness which suggested that it was the principal object of his care or solicitation. It was evident that time was of no importance to him, for he was ready alike to smooth a couch, help a patient to a more desirable location, or throw his arm around another who wished to take a walk. I could not hear his voice, but I was confident from his demeanor that not a little of the success accomplished was due to his cheery conversation, which seemed to impart the strength of which they stood so much in need. Any one of these, or numerous other services being rendered, he would tarry a while, then with a kindly wave of the hand turn away and look for an opportunity to lend some other assistance wherever it should be asked, or he with his alert perception deemed it beneficial. It so happened that I had time to observe him well before he reached me, and all ideas of his being a stranger to me, or I to him, had vanished from my mind. I had risen from my couch, but the half droll, half reproachful look sparkling in his eyes as he came to meet me made me forget my previous intention to apologize if I had committed any error in using the floral couch on which I had taken my sleep, for I felt conscious that I had only an indulgent friend, shall I say, father, to deal with. As he came up, his hand was extended to take mine, which he clasped and shook in true fraternal greeting, gave his shoulders a very peculiar and significant shrug, inclined his head towards his left side, and looked humorously into my eyes, as he asked, "May I offer my congratulations this time?" "This time?" I repeated, taxing my memory as to where I could possibly have seen him before. Now, said he, shaking his head and one finger in a humorously menacing manner. "You have been napping, and I caught you at it." "Yes, I have been sleeping," I replied, "but I am sorry if I have caused you any trouble or inconvenience by so doing." "Hush, hush, hush, hush. Don't apologize," he said, "that which is natural is right, and never needs to be repented of. As to trouble and inconvenience, you parted from them as you came through the mists, and if you wish to renew their acquaintance, I am afraid you will be disappointed, for they could not exist in this life. I hope then, that by sleeping I have not interfered with your arrangements, for I presume you are the friend I expected to meet me here." "Yes, I'm Kushner, and as to your sleeping, why, that was more an item in the program than a disturbance of the same." "I am glad to hear that. But, tell me, have I been sleeping for long, for I have not the least idea?" "Neither have I," he replied, with another of those significant shrugs of the shoulders which I found to be indicative of a vein of humor passing through his mind. Then he continued, "You see, it may be that we are at a disadvantage in that respect, or, on the other hand, it may be fortunate we have no idea of time, since, in the first place, we have no clocks here, and then, if we had, they would not go." "Why not?" "Let me explain. This very pleasant spot is the home of rest, and all who are here come for that purpose. Now you understand that there was nothing extraordinary in my finding you asleep. Well, in the long, long ago, how long I have no idea, but probably in the early years of Earth's history, it is said that time paid a visit to this home, and was so delighted with the facilities for rest and repose that it stopped, and no one has induced it to move since. That is why I cannot say how long you slept, and also the reason why clocks would not go if we had them. Is it not a good one?"
"Excellent. But I am surprised, that is very probable," he rejoined, before I could finish my sentence. "Surprise is a native of this life, and whenever you see her you will find her face bright with pleasant smiles, and she is a very delightful companion to grow acquainted with. When she visits the earth, she frequently disguises herself with a veil of disappointment, and pays her visits in the shades of the gloaming, so that but few people have any idea that she is one of God's favorite angels. But here you will soon learn to love her, and catch yourself listening for her silvery voice in every dell, and looking for the brightness of her coming from every hill, top. No one of the angels contributes so much to our enjoyment in this life as she does, and her visits are always welcome and courted. Under such circumstances, I can well understand that surprises are pleasant things. But I did not think it possible to sleep here.
And why not? He asked.
Sleep is the bride of weariness, and so exemplary is their attachment to each other, that slander has been disarmed before them, and no suspicion has ever marred their nuptial bond. Sleep sometimes is coy, but like the rest of womankind, she plays the part in order to excite her lover's wooing, and he who seeks to win her best regards, can only gain his purpose in ministering to the requirements of her spouse. Therefore, where weariness is, sleep will come, and where the one is to be found, there is no necessity for the other. When you have been toiling under the weight of a heavy burden, you may lay that down. But the fatigue it has occasioned cannot be so easily laid beside it, when a sickness has been struggled with and subdued. The consequent prostration has still to be overcome, but if that illness prove to be the victor, and secures the divorcement of the soul from the body, think you some miracle is wrought to overcome the weariness of the struggle? Everything in nature, animal, vegetable, and mineral, has its season of repose. After all labor cometh rest. Why should we expect to find an exception in the case of the wearied soul? The conflict and the battle over, does it not still require recuperation and sleep to regain its healthful vigor? So he giveth his beloved sleep. And in that sleep the boundary is passed at which weariness is compelled to say adieu. Do all persons sleep on entering this life? Not necessarily. Sleep divides two states of the soul's developments, as night divides 2 days. Some persons, when they reach this life, have not attained to such a standard as to dispense with it, and their condition remains much as it was before, until they are unable to reach one of the many homes similar to this where they pass the boundary line and, then, being beyond the reach of weariness, never require to sleep again. Others, again, pass the spiritual standard before leaving the earth, and so make but a temporary stay here, while growing accustomed to their new surroundings, they then pass on to higher homes. I feel as if I could never become familiarized to such a life. It is so strange, or, rather, so different from what I expected. It has so many revelations, so much that I need to have explained that I can fancy eternity will scarcely be long enough for me to understand it all. We shall never be able to understand it all, my brother, he answered, with a depth of pathos that I had not heard in him before. I am only just beginning to comprehend, and others, who have reached far higher glories than I have attained to, say the same thing. The highest soul with which we are acquainted says he is but standing upon the shore, looking out and across the sea of infinity, over which he needs an eternity to sail, but he knows not what lies beyond for him to solve and explore before he can discern all the fullness of glory and development God has prepared for our future enjoyment. All we can do is to seek to know that which is here around us. When we have comprehended that, the law of this existence will raise us to wider and higher fields of contemplation, and so we shall mount the ladder whose top rests against the throne of God. Such is a delightful occupation, and all the more so because everything is conducive to knowledge, so far as I have been able to understand, so different to what I was taught or led to expect. But when I look inwards and see my limited powers, then outwards and find that every question I ask gives birth to 100 others in the reply it receives, I almost fear to think of the time that must elapse before I can begin to climb. What I have already seen is more of heaven than I had ever dreamed, more than I feel I shall ever have the power to grasp. How can I hope to move? I can fully appreciate the feeling which overpowers you, he said. What you are I was once, and with a lively recollection of my own experience, it gives me much joy to help you at the commencement of your journey. As for the time which must be spent in these studies, take no care. I told you time had stopped, so whatever may be necessary for the accomplishment of God's design in you, will not in any way diminish the remainder. In this the arithmetic of eternity varies from that of time, when you have subtracted all the ages required to perfect your education, the infinite quantity remaining will always be the same. Whenever you see anything you do not understand, ask, and when you ask stand still, and do not hesitate to wait until you have mastered your inquiries. In this way you will soon learn, and to assist in such explanation will be a source of pleasure to every soul you meet. That I have already discovered, for since my arrival I have done nothing but question every friend I have met. Continue to do so, you will then find that knowledge is more easily acquired than you imagine at present. I will not forget your advice. But, tell me, is it customary for newly arrived persons to travel as I have done? The law of love, by which alone we are governed, is a very flexible one, he answered, and adapts itself to every individual requirement, the system of administration being with a view to secure the greatest results in every direction. Therefore the watchers at the mists scrutinize every soul on arrival, not to judge, that being no part of their duty, but to assist to the full extent of their power. They are skilled in reading character, learn the tastes and disposition of all who pass them, and flash their communications to central stations for the peculiar aid required for each individual. In less time than it takes me to explain, the most suitable provision is made, and one or more attendants are dispatched to meet the friend in the arena or on the slopes, which is the appointed meeting place. How do they recognize the particular stranger they are deputed to help in all the multitude passing to and fro? By the robes they wear. But where so many are of the same color, do they not make frequent mistakes? Never. The messengers engaged in that work are too well initiated into their duties to make any error. The colors may appear alike to you, but to them there are distinguishing shades, each of which indicates a corresponding feature of the mind, and having also certain peculiarities to which individual ministers are assigned. There is no possibility of any mistake. Is this strictly infallible as a guide? Yes. That is produced by the spiritual chemistry of the life they have lived, and nothing is able to change or falsify it. It is a testimony which cannot lie. Directly we see your dress, the blending of pink and blue, we know that you have a desire to learn the truth and an open mind to receive it, since blue denotes truth and pink charity. There are other indications that at present you would not be able to understand, which tell of your search after truth, and disappointment in the past. Therefore whoever sees you will be anxious to afford all available assistance in rectifying past failures. This is why you are invited to travel, that you may satisfy your thirst for truth by seeing it as it is. I appreciate your goodness, I replied, and hope you will not find me a too troublesome student. We are not afraid of that, and now, if you are sufficiently rested, let me give you an insight into some of the services we are called upon to render to the different friends we have entrusted to our care in this home. With this he rose from the couch where he had been sitting beside me during our conversation, and placing his arm within my own, led me away in the direction from which he came when I first saw him. Was I wrong in thinking these are the grounds of a convalescent home or sanatorium? I asked, as we walked along. Not very, he answered, and I am about to ask your attention to the means we employ in administering to the restoration of some who are weak and helpless. Chapter 6 A Magnetic Corral. As we walked along, my attention was attracted by the chiming of a peal of bells in the distance, and simultaneously an irresistible fascination seized upon me, momentarily increasing, until, at length I felt as if was being impelled forward by some invisible but tangible influence to accept the invitation those rhythmic tongues were issuing far and wide. What that influence was or how it obtained such a mastery over me, I could not tell, and even now, with my more extended experience of this life, I am unable to explain. The sensation produced was novel, entrancing, and indescribable. Its operation seemed to permeate my whole being, and to exert itself equally from within as without. Neither was it due entirely to my recent arrival, for I perceived that it had the same effect upon my guide as upon myself. By some accountable process I translated the voice of those bells into an appeal for help and assistance which I alone had the power to render, and though I had no inclination to hasten in obedience to call, I was certain that it would not be right to delay. But why should it be me, was a question that I put to myself again and again. I was entirely ignorant of everything surrounding me. Why was not the summons to many others walking in the same direction, gathering, as it were, from every visible point of the compass? And as I thus queried, I scanned the faces of those nearest to me, and became convinced that they too were moving under the impulse of that same mysterious power. This discovery served to further increase my interest and excite my imagination as to what the result and explanation would be. My companion saw, and no doubt fully understood, the perplexity I was enduring, but when I turned and would have sought the interpretation, he merely smiled, and my tongue was silent. So we went forward in obedience to the one impulse attracting us both by its strange magnetic power. Presently another source of gratification was afforded me, as through the trees I began to catch in the distance broken glimpses of a stately pile of buildings which we were steadily approaching. Hitherto, I had only seen such, as I looked across the boundless landscape under the direction of Erasmus, but now, it was evident that I was to have the opportunity of inspecting one of the homes of paradise at close quarters. With this, a pleasing spasm of excitement seized me as I involuntarily asked myself, "Will this be my home?" A question I at the same time answered in the negative, but how I know not, unless it was by the power of revelation which is so natural, and yet so infallibly a part of our personality in this life. Therefore I ceased to speculate on the ownership of the home, and prepared to examine its character as soon as circumstances would allow of my doing so. Immediately we reached the open plain, the center and crown of which it occupied, I intuitively knew that I was looking upon the home of rest, or sanatorium, in the grounds of which I had enjoyed my refreshing and rejuvenating sleep. As the physiognomy of a man affords a certain index to his character and disposition, so the contour of this home declared at once its nature and purpose. At a glance I saw it was a citadel of repose, a fortress of rest, an ambuscade of joy to every soul that came that way. Stately and grand in its unassuming magnificence, as if its foundations were laid deep down within the eternal calm of God's omnipotence, pure and unsullied in its fabric as the infinite and changeless love of its divine designer, every stone and feature apparently throbbing with the spirit of mercy and forgiveness which hovered around, I felt as I gazed upon it that I in some manner had solved the mystery of that profound attraction by which I had been drawn towards such a desirable center. Reverence, gratitude, worship and awe, seemed to be the janitors who stood as guards at the four towers which rose at the terminating points of its stately porticos. So much of the building as was visible from where we stood, for me to wonder at and admire its beauties, was undoubtedly a hall of enormous proportions, its shape that of an amphitheatre. Three sides were flanked by spacious piazzas of equal length, carrying out the design to a perfect square, the corners being occupied by four towers which served the purpose of entrances to the hall. The style of architecture was composite, the columns supporting the roof of the porticos were Corinthian, their material more resembling ivory than marble, the plinths upon which they rested were of pinkish alabaster, and massive enough to form the corner, stones of pyramids, but whereas the Egyptians would have left a sphinx, like blank upon their faces, these were panelled with exquisite bas-reliefs such as the Grecians loved to carve, the pediments were used as galleries for groups of statuary in the contemplation of which the convalescent inmates of home might learn progressive lessons of the life to which they had been called. In that self-illumined atmosphere which offered no facility for the birth of shadows, from the distance at which I stood the walls of the hall appeared to be built of stone of a delicate and variable shade of green. I afterwards discovered that this effect was produced by a magnificent screen of elaborately carved and perforated marble, draped around the hall in folds as exquisite and soft as lace, through which the foliage of a noble vine was visible. The towers rose to a considerable height, terminating in minarets like polished silver, from which the bells chimed forth their music, and, crowning the hall rose a majestic dome serving the double purpose of completing design and lighting the interior. The wonderful appositeness of every feature of the scene to each other was again impressed upon me, art and nature being blended in such manner as to enrich the harmony. That garden, like plain so artistically dotted with flowers and shrubs, would have been half voided of its beauty had that noble structure not been there, and as for the hall, it needed that flower-bejeweled mantle of a lawn as a fit setting whereon to display its matchless perfection. blended together, the beauties of each were emphasized, while the movements of the multitude kept the balance of the harmony swinging. Krishna moved forward, and I, enraptured with the scene and wondering what its next development would be, mechanically followed, until I became conscious that it was not his intention to enter by any of the approaches visible to me. Then for a moment I wavered, as all my soul called me within that place, and I was doubtful whether he was not leading me elsewhere. In an instant he divined my difficulty, and appeared to be by no means displeased thereat, but assuring me he was about to enter, led me to the main portion of the building, before hidden from my sight, and which formed the temporary abode of those who tarried at this home for rest and recuperation. At that moment the bells ceased to ring, and I was glad when, without attempting to show me the numerous apartments opening on every hand, he motioned me to follow him along a corridor which led in the direction of the hall. At the end, drawing aside a richly embroidered curtain, he ushered me at once into what I may legitimately call the arena. Shall I describe the scene which met my sight? It was a mountain of faces on every side, and over and around us an atmosphere of unbroken peace. I was conscious that I had reached a goal. A period of uncertainty lay behind me. For the time I felt satisfied, and drew a deep breath of relief at having accomplished something, I knew not what, but my heart was glad. The flower-carpeted floor of that spacious arena contained a number of lounges composed of various aromatic mosses, soft as air, each one designed to produce its own peculiar effect magnetically. Krishna drew my attention to the different odors they exhaled, and invited me to throw myself upon them to test their comfort, and, as I complied, briefly explained that magnetism is the strength and nourishment of the spiritual body. Then he led me to a vacant seat, and left me in charge of a friend, who, he said, would interpret the chorale to me. Rapidly that spacious auditorium was filling up its seats. Tier after tier, rising one above another, contributed to that sea of faces, upon every one of which happiness had set her name in living characters. From each of the four entrances a steady stream poured in until the hall was full, ceasing when just one seat remained for the last who entered. The dresses worn were of many colors, but only of the lighter shades, all serving to make the groupings as picturesque as they were varied. The lower seats were filled by children wearing robes of spotless white, or tints of the most imaginable delicacy, some of the wearers being of such tender age as to make me wonder how they were kept in the quiet order which everywhere prevailed. Behind these, thousands of youths and maidens were arranged according to some method I did not understand. Above these, again, were women in greater proportions still, and finally rank after rank of men to the outer edge of that wide circle. Every nation upon earth had its legitimate representation in that throng, and all were so disposed that each complexion added its own influence to the balance of the picture. But the most pleasing thought of all was that every voice would say "Our Father" to the self-same God, and feel at heart that they were members of one family. The Jew was not conscious of election, the Gentile had lost his hatred, the caste restriction of the Brahmin was broken down, the hand of the Arab was no more against his fellow. The Hindu woman had doffed her veil, the Mohammedan had lost his bigotry, Greek and Roman thought not of deadly feuds, the hand of the Zulu held no assegai, the Indian had no tomahawk, while the Christian had sheathed his sword. Romanist and Protestant gave the preference to each other. The Episcopalian boasted of no apostolic succession, and the narrow-minded sectarian sat side by side with the former atheist, whom he had before consigned fire eternal. In such a multitude, with such a bond uniting them, I could fancy that I was not very far removed from the inner shrine of heaven. Was it the association in which I found myself that started such a train of reflection in my mind? I know not, perhaps never shall know, but it afterwards resolved itself into an impromptu symphony, introducing that never, too, be forgotten chorale. I had scarcely reached its termination before the keynote sounded. In common with those around me, I raised my eyes to the dome, where a dove of tintless electric brilliance poised itself on outstretched wing, as if to hush the tremor of its rapid flight. In its beak it held something which flashed and blazed with a glory that paled the luster of its carrier, and added perceptibly to the hallowed light which bathed the hall. With one impulse, but without a sound, those thousands rose and bowed their heads in reverent adoration, and when the silence had been hushed into an awful calm, the quickened sense of the soul could almost hear that jewel fluttered on the air, and like a flash of lightning dying from our sight, the dove had disappeared.